Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey there, Herman and Corin. So I mentioned, or we touched upon in a previous episode, some of the interventions that can make a rental market better. I mentioned that I've been renting for 10 years in Israel, and I worry about my own finances to be honest, and I also worry about what this is doing to our generation. I'll explain what I mean. In all these years of renting, if we ever get off the rental spiral, renting is terrible financially, right? You're every month you're taking money that you earn and you're paying off someone else's mortgage. But I think that what people fail to understand is the combination of factors that make renting, I think, it almost feels like a financial apocalypse. To take my example in Israel of various rental horror stories and nightmares, I mentioned that I was one of my first rentals, the landlord just ripped out the toilet to find the leak, but they, you know, didn't actually put the toilet back. So my bathroom became just literally a pile of jackhammered concrete. Our latest thing here, which is why I've been a bit stressed the past 2 weeks, is that we had a leak, which the landlord refused to fix, saying it's not my problem that there's a leak, even though the law says you have to fix it. And it just got worse and worse and worse. Spread, mold formed, plaster was falling off the wall. And then on top of everything, said, I'm not going to speak to you anymore. So we're like, okay. We had to get legal advice. It's been an incredibly stressful period. And the best case scenario is that we can get out of this place at the end of our contract. But again, each of these experiences whereby, you know, you rent a place and let's say our last place, which was probably our best and most stable experience to date, the landlord just gave away the property to a family member. Nothing wrong. It's his prerogative as, you know, a landlord to do that. But it really underscores to me the absolute vulnerability of renting. The other thing, because each of these moves, and I'm just, again, talking about my experience, you accumulate, if you settle down, you accumulate belongings. You might have a child, then you've got more things. And even if you try to pare down your things, which believe me, we've done, you still have things. And the only alternative is to just kind of live your life as a nomad. It's also, I think, very destabilizing from just a human life standpoint, where, you know, you never really know if your tenancy is going to be resumed. But the cost of these moves is what I think is the really hard part. Not to mention the lost time in from work that you're setting up and resetting up the same utilities over and over again. So when people talk about renting being bad, I don't think they're even beginning to kind of capture how financially, emotionally, and I would almost say spiritually draining of an existence it is. So it's a very bleak topic, which is why I sometimes just prefer not to think about it. But now that I am thinking about it at the moment, I'm thinking about ways that this could be less atrocious, because when you have these experiences, like the crazy experiences I just described, one of the worst parts is just feeling like you're the only one. But then you start reaching out to friends and you just hear other horror stories. So it scares me that there's a whole generation of people who are following a path that until recently was just kind of the normal way to become socially mobile, to earn your house, to be able to afford a house and to have some baseline of stability. And now that that's kind of gone, it leaves a huge gap in its wake. So in the last episode, we talked about Germany and Singapore, and I thought that was really interesting about those examples was it challenges, I think part of the problem here is that, and in most countries for that matter, is we treat the supply of housing just like we do the supply of internet or bananas. But it's not. It's the supply of a fundamental human need. And that concept of preventing landlords from just, capriciously ending contracts for whatever reason they want, it brings some stability to the market. Now, you could say that's very adversarial to the interest of landlords. But, I would argue back that the interest of landlords is in really investment property at the expense of housing for another group of people. So it's a form of capitalism that I think is predatory and damaging when you really think about it. So I'm actually in favor of very interventionist policies in the rental market. The other ones that I'd like to discuss in today's episode, Herman and Corin, is in light of this experience and previous ones I've had, there's been an attempt to legislate improvements to rentals in Israel through the Fair Rental Law. And I've mentioned in blogs I've written that it seems to have had zero effect. You see this in when you're looking for a place, because realtors essentially have cornered the viewing market and they find a legal loophole to charge you fees. And part of what I found so devastating about this experience is that it's after the passage of the legislation, and you try reaching out to the municipality to, you try citing the law to your landlords, and they just don't care. They're not concerned about whatever consequences they might face. So the law, to me, has been a total failure in this regard. But what I was, one thing I was thinking about was that in the UK, they have a landlord registry, I believe. And when I hear about repeat slumlords who are known to maybe local law offices or even long-term tenants, it seems strange to me that they're just allowed to operate freely by kind of squashing tenants into abject defeat, which is, I think, usually their objective. It's to prey on people who don't know their rights, or to count on the fact that people will just give up and get exhausted and move out. So that's another intervention that I would love to learn about more in this episode of Herman and Corin. And really everything else that, as I mentioned previously, there's two ways to look at, I think, the housing situation. One is we have to find a way so that formula that used to apply is viable again, that if you work hard, you can earn the roof over your head and get a mortgage and not waste so much money on this horrible process we call renting. Or the other one is a greatly increased level of government intervention in rental markets. Stop treating rent like we're selling carrots, and bring in all these safeguards that we've seen happen in other jurisdictions. And that's what I'd like to talk about today, Herman and Corin. Besides Germany, the German case, what are some other examples of countries that have tackled this issue thoughtfully? And really, besides the immediate need of housing, I think the more long-term need of ensuring that people who are renting or have to rent don't end up long-term with their long-term finances crippled through this repetitive cycle I've described: renting, contracts ending, moving costs, disruption, and just this endless cycle of kind of wasting money and being too defeated to even think about owning property. Herman and Corin, over to you.
Hey everyone, welcome back to My Weird Prompts. I'm Corin, and I'm sitting here in our living room in Jerusalem with my brother, Herman Poppleberry.
Good to be here, Corin. And I have to say, Daniel really hit a nerve with the prompt he sent us this week. He's been reflecting on his 10 years of renting here in Israel, and frankly, it sounds like he's been through the ringer.
It's been a rough couple of weeks in this house, to be honest. Between the landlord issues and the legal research, it's been a lot. Daniel was telling us about how he's moved so many times, and each move just feels like this massive financial and emotional drain. It got him thinking about why the system feels so broken for long-term renters, and he wanted us to look at how other countries are handling this.
Exactly. He specifically mentioned the Fair Rental Law we have here in Israel, which was supposed to fix things back when it passed in 2017, but in practice, for many people, it feels like it has zero effect. We're going to dive into what's actually happening in places like the United Kingdom, the Netherlands, Denmark, and Finland to see if there's a better way to treat housing as a fundamental need rather than just a speculative asset.
I think that's the core of the problem, right? We treat an apartment the same way we treat a pair of sneakers or a car. But you can't just opt out of having a roof over your head. When the market fails for sneakers, you just don't buy them. When it fails for housing, people end up in the situations Daniel described, where they're essentially trapped in a cycle of instability.
Right, and that instability is expensive. Every time you move, you're looking at professional movers, cleaning costs, new security deposits, and often a jump in rent. It's a massive hidden tax on anyone who doesn't own their home.
So let's start with the local context, since that's what triggered this. The Fair Rental Law of 2017 in Israel was a big deal when it was enacted. It defined what a habitable apartment actually is. It said you need a bathroom with a door, working electricity, and sewage. It sounds basic, but before that, even those standards weren't clearly codified.
It also capped the security deposit at 3 months' rent, or one-third of the total annual rent, whichever is lower. And it mandated that landlords have to fix reasonable damage within 30 days, or 3 days if it's an emergency. But here's the kicker, corn. It didn't do anything about rent control or long-term security of tenure.
That's where it falls apart for most people. A landlord can still decide not to renew your lease for no reason at all, or they can hike the rent by 20%, effectively forcing you out. It creates this constant low-level anxiety. You never really know if you'll still be in your home next year.
And that's exactly what Daniel was talking about with the UK example. They've actually made some massive moves recently. The Renters' Rights Act received royal assent in April of 2024. This is a huge shift for England.
Wait, I remember reading about that. One of the biggest changes is the end of Section 21, right?
Exactly. Section 21 was the infamous no-fault eviction. It allowed landlords to evict tenants with just 2 months' notice without providing any reason. Under the new act, which starts rolling out its first phase in May of 2026, those are being abolished. Landlords will now need a specific, valid legal reason to end a tenancy, like wanting to sell the property or moving back in themselves.
That seems like a massive win for stability. If you're a good tenant who pays on time, you suddenly have the right to stay. But how do they enforce it? Because laws are only as good as their enforcement.
That's the other big piece. They're creating a mandatory national private rented sector database. It's basically a landlord registry, which is something Daniel was asking about. By late 2026, every private landlord in England will have to register themselves and their properties. If they aren't on that database, they literally cannot legally market the property or use the court system to regain possession.
That's a huge shift in the power dynamic. It's not just a list of names, it's a compliance tool. Tenants will be able to check the database to see if their landlord has a history of banning orders or if the property meets safety standards.
It turns the Wild West of private renting into a regulated industry. And if a landlord gives false information, they're looking at fines that can go up to £40,000. It's designed to weed out the slumlord types that Daniel has had to deal with.
I love the idea of transparency, but I wonder if it actually helps with the cost. Stability is great, but if the rent is still skyrocketing, you're still getting priced out eventually.
That's where the Netherlands comes in. They just passed the Affordable Rent Act, which went into effect on July 1st, 2024. This one is fascinating because it tackles the middle market, which is usually where people like us get stuck.
Usually, rent control only applies to social housing for very low-income families, right?
Traditionally, yes. But the Dutch have this point system called the WWS, or the Housing Valuation System. It assigns points based on things like square footage, the energy efficiency label, the kitchen amenities, and even the quality of the outdoor space. Before 2024, if your apartment had enough points to be above a certain threshold, it was in the free sector, and the landlord could charge whatever they wanted.
And I'm guessing the threshold was low enough that almost everything in a city like Amsterdam was in the free sector.
Precisely. But the new law expanded the regulated segment. Now, properties with up to 186 points are regulated. As of late 2024, that meant a maximum rent of about €1,158. If your apartment's quality only justifies 150 points, the landlord literally cannot legally charge you more than the price set for that point score.
That's incredible. It's like a price-to-quality ratio that's legally mandated. Does it actually work, or do landlords just find ways around it?
Well, the Dutch made it mandatory for landlords to disclose the point score to the tenant, and starting in January of 2025, municipalities gained the power to fine landlords who overcharge. They expect this will eventually lower the rent for about 300,000 homes by an average of nearly €200 a month.
It's a bold move. It treats housing more like a regulated utility. If the quality is X, the price can't exceed Y. It takes the speculative frenzy out of the equation. But I can hear the counter-argument already. Doesn't this stop people from building new houses? If they can't make a massive profit, why would they build?
That's the classic debate. But the Dutch countered that by allowing a 10% rent surcharge for 20 years on new buildings completed after the law went into effect. It's a compromise to keep developers interested while protecting tenants from price gouging.
It feels like a much more sophisticated approach than what we're used to. It's not just a blanket rent freeze. It's a quality-based regulation. Now, Daniel also mentioned Vienna. I know we've talked about them before, but they're always the gold standard, aren't they?
They really are. In Vienna, about 60% of the population lives in some form of subsidized housing. And the key is that it's not just for the poor. The income caps are surprisingly high. For 2025, a single person can earn up to 59,320 euros a year and still qualify for a municipal or subsidized flat. For a two-person household, that cap is over 88,000 euros.
That's basically the majority of the middle class. When 60% of your city lives in non-market housing, the remaining 40% in the private market has to compete with those prices.
Exactly. It has a massive price dampening effect on the whole city, and they're making it even easier to navigate. In 2026, they're launching a central Vienna housing ticket that combines the registration for municipal and cooperative apartments into one system. They've also removed the requirement that you have to live at a single address for 2 years. Now, as long as you've been in Vienna for 2 years total, you're eligible.
It sounds like they're actively trying to remove barriers for people whose lives are a bit more mobile, like students or people changing jobs. But the real genius of Vienna is the long-term thinking. They've been building this since the interwar period of Red Vienna in the 1920s. It's a century of investment.
It's a commitment to the idea that housing is a public task. They spend about 500 million euros a year on construction and renovation. It's not an afterthought, it's the core of their urban policy.
Let's talk about Denmark for a second, because they have a system that feels like a middle ground between the Dutch regulation and the Viennese state model.
You're thinking of the Almene Boliger, the non-profit housing associations. About 1 million Danes, which is 1/6 of the entire population, live in these. These aren't owned by the state, they're owned by non-profit organizations.
And the rents are strictly cost-based, right?
Right. No one is allowed to make a profit from the rent. The rent is set at a level that covers the operating costs, the mortgage, and the maintenance. Once the mortgage is paid off, usually after 30 or 40 years, 2/3 of those savings go into a national building fund. That fund then finances the renovation of old buildings and the construction of new ones.
That's a beautiful closed-loop system. It's a revolving door of capital that stays within the housing sector, instead of being extracted by shareholders or private landlords.
And it's incredibly democratic. Each housing estate is managed by a committee elected by the tenants. They decide on the budget, the renovations, and the house rules. It gives people a sense of ownership even if they're renting. It's what they call tenant democracy.
That's a huge psychological shift. If you feel like you have a say in how your building is run, you're much more likely to stay long term. It becomes a community, not just a place you're passing through.
It addresses exactly what Daniel was saying about the emotional drain. In the Danish system, you're a member of a community with rights, not just a customer whose contract can be terminated.
I want to touch on Finland too, because their approach to the most extreme end of the housing crisis is legendary. We've all heard about housing first, but how is it holding up?
It's still the global benchmark, though they've had a bit of a reality check recently. For 11 years straight, homelessness in Finland was falling, but in 2024, for the first time in over a decade, it actually rose. The latest data from ARA, the Finnish housing center, showed an increase in homelessness in early 2025.
What happened? Did the model fail?
Most experts point to a combination of things. There were significant cuts to social security and housing benefits in 2024, and the cost of living just outpaced the support systems. But the fundamental philosophy hasn't changed. They still believe that housing is a basic human right that you provide first before you try to fix other issues like employment or health.
It's a radical reversal of the usual logic where you have to prove you're worthy of a house by getting a job or staying sober. Finland says you can't do any of that without a stable home first.
And even with that slight rise, their numbers are incredibly low compared to almost any other developed nation. They've largely eradicated rough sleeping in Helsinki. They only have one 50-bed night shelter left because almost everyone has a permanent roof over their head.
So we've looked at all these big national models, but Daniel asked a very practical question. How do we ensure long-term renters aren't financially crippled by the cycle of instability and moving costs?
There are some really interesting smaller-scale interventions for that. Take Portland, Oregon, for example. In 2016, they passed a mandatory renter relocation assistance law, which went into effect in 2017.
I remember you mentioning this. If a landlord issues a no-fault eviction or hikes the rent by 10% or more in a 12-month period, they have to pay the tenant a relocation fee.
Exactly. Depending on the size of the apartment, that fee can be anywhere from $2,900 to $4,500. It's designed to make the landlord share the financial burden of the move they're causing.
That's a massive deterrent for arbitrary evictions. If it's going to cost you $4,000 just to get a tenant out so you can hike the rent, you might think twice. It internalizes the cost of the instability.
Exactly. It's about shifting the cost of the market's whims from the most vulnerable person to the one who's actually making the decision.
We also need to talk about the length of leases. In Israel and the US, a one-year lease is the standard. It's almost comical. You spend 3 months moving in and unpacking, and then 6 months later, you're already worried about whether you'll get a renewal notice.
It's absurd. In Germany, which we touched on briefly in the past, indefinite leases are the norm. You sign a contract, and it's yours until you decide to leave, as long as you follow the rules. In the Netherlands, the new law we discussed also restricted the use of temporary leases. Indefinite agreements are becoming the standard again.
Imagine the psychological relief of knowing you could stay in your apartment for 10, 15, or 20 years. You could actually invest in the place. You could paint the walls, put down a nice rug, and treat it like a home.
And you'd be more invested in the neighborhood. You'd know your neighbors, you'd support local businesses, and your kids would stay in the same school. The social capital that's lost when people are forced to move every 2 years is immeasurable.
So, if we were to design a better system for a place like Israel or any high-pressure market, what are the key ingredients?
First, you need a mandatory landlord registry like the UK. Transparency is the foundation. If we don't know who owns what and what the conditions are, we can't enforce anything.
Second, a point system like the Dutch WWS. It anchors the price to the actual quality of the home. It stops people from charging 4,000 shekels for a converted storage room with a leaky ceiling.
Third, you need a massive expansion of non-profit or cooperative housing. We need to follow the Danish or Viennese models and take a chunk of the housing stock out of the speculative market entirely.
And finally, relocation assistance. If a landlord wants to disrupt someone's life, they should help pay for it. It's about fairness.
It's also about treating housing as a utility. We don't let the water company suddenly decide to double your rates because they feel like it, or cut off your service because they want to sell the water to someone else. We recognize that water is essential. We need to start recognizing that a stable home is just as essential.
I think the most powerful thing Daniel said in his prompt was that renting feels spiritually draining. That's a heavy phrase, but it's true. When you feel like you're just a guest in your own life, always waiting for the other shoe to drop, it wears you down.
It really does. And the irony is that many of the people who are suffering in this system are the ones we rely on the most. Teachers, nurses, social workers. If they can't afford to live in the cities where they work, the whole urban fabric starts to unravel.
It feels like we're at a tipping point. The models in the UK and the Netherlands are brand new. They're responses to a crisis that has become politically untenable. People are finally saying that the old way isn't working.
I'm hopeful, though. Seeing countries like the UK finally abolish no-fault evictions after decades of advocacy is huge. It shows that the policy needle can move if there's enough pressure.
And for our listeners who are in the middle of this struggle, I think it's important to remember that it doesn't have to be this way. There are proven models that work. It's not a mystery. It's a choice. We've chosen to prioritize property as an investment, but we could choose to prioritize it as a home.
Well said, Korn. And I think that's a good place to wrap this one up. It's a complex topic, and we've barely scratched the surface of some of these international models, but hopefully it gives some perspective on the possibilities.
Definitely. And thanks to Daniel for sending this in. It's been on all of our minds lately, and I'm glad we got to dig into the research.
If you're listening and you've had similar experiences, or if you live in one of the countries we mentioned and want to tell us how it actually feels on the ground, we'd love to hear from you.
You can find us at myweirdprompts.com. There's a contact form there, and you can also find our full archive and the RSS feed.
And hey, if you've been enjoying the show, we'd really appreciate a quick review on your podcast app or on Spotify. It genuinely helps other people find us and keeps the show growing.
Yeah, it makes a big difference. We're on Spotify and all the major platforms. Just search for My Weird Prompts.
All right, I think that's it for episode 2W95.
Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll be back next week with another weird prompt.
Until next time.
Bye.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox Turbo.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.